Hey, podcast listeners, it's Michael Shelley. Okay, here's the deal. John Doe was on the program just about exactly a year ago, and we talked about his whole entire life. So I didn't want to repeat that, but the opportunity to talk to him again I thought might be interesting. So we just talked about his new book a little bit. You know, you'll hear it. His life with X, his life now, his poison ivy. I don't know. So when this is over, you'll hear this. It's only about 15 minutes long. Then you'll hear our talk from a year ago. So some of you may have already heard that one, so you can tune off. But if you are just joining the podcast family, you'll get to hear two interviews with John Doe, and they're not particularly redundant, mostly new and improved. So, interesting guy. I'm not entirely sure I have my finger on who he is or why he is exactly, but I like him. And great songwriter, great singer, just a dedicated human being. I like him. He's genuine. Okay, keep your eyes on WFMU.org/Michael for a list of who's coming up. Amy Rigby is one, I know that much. And that's it. Hope to cross paths with you soon. Here's John Doe first from this week and then from 1 year ago. Thanks. There is Get On Board from John Doe from the brand new album called The Westerner. It's a great opening track for a record because it sort of invites people into the record, and the record is its own kind of sonic thing. Anyway, good morning. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Come on, people. Now, smile on your brother. Get on board.
Are you? Is there a religious aspect to your life?
No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Not really. Not an organized. I feel much more spiritually connected in the last 10 years or so.
Why is that?
Because there's something greater than just us, and I don't know what the hell it is, but I feel it.
Yeah, well, so what changed in the last 10 years?
I got older. And, no, I see it like in, I've always believed that there's a spiritual aspect to the land and what lives on it. So I'm like a pagan in that way, I suppose. Because I believe that animals have spirit and the land has spirit. I'm starting to believe in, like, past lives and goofy crap like that.
You're turning into Shirley MacLaine in your old age.
We could only hope that we're as lucky to be Shirley MacLaine in our older years.
Yeah, let's start with the record. I mean, it's, you know, I'm looking at, every time I think about you, it's, I look at this catalog that you've built since the early days of X, and it's really been nonstop and always interesting, you know. And how do you so tell me how the new record came together, why it sounds the way it sounds, and if you think your productivity is like just a gift from nature, or is it something you've worked really hard at, or somewhere in between?
Oh, wow, that's a lot of stuff.
It's like 20 questions.
I'll do it. Yeah, I'll do it in a short order. I was inspired by my friend Michael Blake, who passed away in 2015. I went to see him many, many, many times over the last 5 years because he had dementia, and he lived in Tucson. Hal Gelb had become, from Giant Sand, had become a good friend. Maybe we reconnected maybe 10 years ago. Big fan of Giant Sand and all the sounds that come out of that Wave Lab Studios, which is where Hal works, i.e. Nico Case or Iron and Wine or Calexico, and the distance and the space and the reverb and everything that comes out of what Hal does. He also worked with Katie Tunstall and a bunch of different people. So I was out visiting Michael. He was losing his freaking mind. And so I thought, well, I started writing songs that used him as a character or just about his life, Michael's life. And Michael Blake wrote Dances with Wolves. So we had known each other for 25 years. And it all made sense that I would do that record out with Hal as co-producer. Hal played guitar on it. I used a lot of the similar musicians that I'd used in the past, but it had just a different space and flavor. And Michael kind of embodied the idea of the Westerner. That's the title that came to me. And then it became more about like the idea of someone from the West. And that's how it came together. And then I saw this image that Shepard Fairey did, and you can't tell whether it's a hippie kid or if it's a Native American kid or whatever. And it's like, no, that's the Westerner, not some John Wayne cowboy SOB. So Shepard's a fan of punk rock, and we had met a few times, and I asked him if he'd repurpose it to be my cover. And Aaron Huey, who took the picture out in South Dakota, the Rosebud Reservation, said sure, and I donated money to them, to this Protect the Treaties Foundation, and la-di-da. Then my friend Jim Harrison Harrington took some pictures, and the picture on the back is me chasing after one of my horses that escaped, which was pretty hilarious. Like the end of the photo shoot is always the best one. Oh, and the other thing is that yes, intuitive songwriting. It is maybe a gift, but it's also 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration. I don't believe that, but I've tried to write songs from an intuitive point of view, from the right side of the brain rather than the left side. Not logic, but just feeling.
But not everybody manages to keep doing it or not become sort of scared of veering off the path. Or, I think some people end up parroting themselves in later years almost, and you've avoided that somehow.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the encouragement. I don't know that that's a whole 100% true. If you go through songs, you can find like, oh, that's kind of like that song, and oh, that's kind of like that song. And the one difference is that I have tried to do things more intuitively. Actually, the X stuff was more logical and more like piecing together, even though there was a lot of inspiration there. But the biggest difference is that some of the songs have an actual happy ending rather than being all negative.
Maybe your new mature perspective, perhaps.
Well, I'm in a pretty positive relationship, and that's a good thing. There was a friend of mine who said, gee, I was listening to that song "Sweet Reward," and I thought that like the other shoe was going to drop, and it was going to be sad at the end. But that turned out to be kind of happy, and I thought, good.
Oh, that's interesting. You've sort of, people are waiting for the bomb in your songs, and it doesn't come.
Yeah. Right.
That's interesting. You have a new book that we were talking about last time you were here, Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. You were putting it together for a while. There's lots of folks have added a chapter, Xene and Henry Rollins and Mike Guad and two of the Go-Go's and Dave Alvin, lots of folks. What did you learn? What did you learn that you didn't know putting the book together? What surprised you?
I think what surprised me is that everyone had a similar take. Everyone realized that there was something going on. They didn't know exactly what. They didn't know how long it was going to last. But they also saw it as very positive, and maybe that's just the lens of the past. But also that everyone saw it as being like special and inclusive, and there was all different kinds of people that were coming together. And that was surprising. What wasn't surprising is that Jane Wiedlands was the dirtiest. That wasn't surprising. Because we all knew when they were America's sweethearts, we all knew that they were pretty crazy punk rock gals.
Book ends in 1982. Why end it there?
5 years was a good number. And honestly, by 82, the Go-Go's had hit records. We had signed to Elektra. The scene had kind of been taken over by the hardcore scene. The original L.A. punk rock scene had been taken over by the hardcore scene. And, it had sort of split off into more roots kind of music. And, by that point, the original inspiration, the original sounds of bands, and that whole eclectic stew had kind of blown apart.
Let me remind everybody, John Doe is our guest. The website is thejohndoe.com, and he's coming to the Outpost in the Burbs in Montclair, New Jersey, a week from today, Saturday, November 5th. Is that with a band, or is that just you? What's the deal?
It's just me, and people can request songs. I can play some stuff, but it's always funny to me that I'll have an acoustic guitar and someone will say, "Play Los Angeles." And I think, what in your mind thinks, what version of Los Angeles would be good on an acoustic guitar without Exene, without Billy? It kind of baffles the mind or boggles the mind. Yeah, just me. I'm actually, it's part of a thing I got invited to do with Exene up at Cornell University. So we're going to go up to Ithaca on the 4th, and then I'm going to come on the way home. I'm going to go down to and play this house party. Fun times.
Yeah, it's in a church, and I've seen shows there, and it's a great place for a guy with an acoustic guitar to play a gig and take requests from people living in 1977. For next year will be 40 years of X, and that's a long time to do any job. And I assume you guys still like each other. I assume you're not doing it just for the money. Tell me what goes on next year to celebrate this.
We're working on it, and so far we're going to play. What we're going to try to do is play 4 nights in each town. So we're going to do like a smaller club with vibes. We have a really interesting show now because we've added another member, Craig Peckham, and he plays drums on a few things, and DJ plays vibes. We play songs that we never – Billy plays sax on a couple songs. We play songs we never played live before. Things like "I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts" or "Come Back to Me" or "Dancing with Tears in My Eyes." And Craig also plays acoustic guitar on a few things. And so then we also play straight-up punk rock. So it's kind of a in-concert show. And we've been doing it for maybe a year or 2 years. But now it's really refined, and we can do it in a way that's not embarrassing if people are sitting down. Like we started doing this because we get requests or offers for, to play performance, performing arts centers, that kind of thing. And it was embarrassing to go there and, like, play this blasting just punk rock. It was weird, you know. So we tried to figure out how we could do that.
Tell me what bands you've ever seen that have blown your mind.
Devo blew my mind. The Cramps blew my mind. And I just saw Nick Knox in Cleveland, which was amazing. I hadn't seen him in 25, 30 years. Who else blew my mind? The Rolling Stones in 1966 blew my mind. That was my first concert. Not a bad way to start.
No, that's great.
Yeah, they just released that High Tides, Green Grass. Big hits. There's a young woman in L.A. that kind of blows my mind, named Phoebe Bridgers. She's just working on her first LP.
I was looking at your biography. It looks like you've done over 60 movies or television shows. You have any of that coming up? That's like a whole nother person almost.
That's the mercenary person who says, "How much do I get paid? How much do I have to fall down?" And do I get 2 tickets on the airplane so my sweetheart can come along? I did one thing up in Oregon, post-apocalyptic thing, and it was just like 20 pages of the script, and they're going to try to put that together and then get financing for the rest of the movie. We're running around outside of Medford, Oregon, and it was all very bucolic and wonderful, and I kept saying, "I'm pretty sure that's poison oak right there." And who got the poison oak? This guy. It makes you feel like a kid. Like a real dumb kid. It was a bummer.
Yeah. I've been there. Terrible. It is the worst, yeah.
Isn't it? It's like, and everywhere you sleep, like, you put your hand, where of course you have it on your wrist or your hand, and then you put that on your thigh, and then you've got it on your thigh. And then you put it on your chest, and then you've got it on your chest. But I did find a new, there's a newfangled thing called TechNu, TECNU, and that's kind of a scrub, and that helped a lot.
I know, I use the, yeah, it's like sandpapery, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yes. It's all that stuff is very efficient poison. You know, it's like incredible. Yeah.
Aye. So every once in a while, but I don't do it as much as you know, I used to.
Tell me, do you have rules to live by that you're conscious of that you take a minute to make sure you're doing?
Yeah, I stretch every morning. And I try to take a drink, a break from drinking now and then, and get a lot of sleep. I think the thing I've learned most recently is just to try to be good to yourself, not to be hard on yourself, to push yourself to achieve and do whatever you want, but just to try to be good to yourself.
You think maybe some people confuse the idea of punk rock lifestyle with abusing yourself, has, you know?
Well, I think they do. I mean, there's all different kinds of definitions of punk rock. But what punk rock wasn't, it wasn't buying into the rock and roll lifestyle. It wasn't groupies and everybody does stuff for you and you just get to live the life of Riley and the you know, extremes or the opulence of the classic rock, which wasn't really even a thing when punk rock started. There wasn't such a thing as classic rock. It was just rock and roll. And then, you know, as Jimmy and Janis and Jim Morrison died, then it was like, oh, hell, we gotta hold on to this. Let's make classic rock radio. That's kind of, Exene talks about that in her book, or in her chapter in the book. But yes, punk rock doesn't necessarily mean abusing yourself.
We're talking to John Doe. New album is called The Westerner. The book is called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. And gig in New Jersey in Montclair at the Outpost in the Burbs on next Saturday, November 5th. You said that you and Exene had a crazy way of singing, and I don't know enough about... I can't describe it, but like there is a certain relationship to the harmony, to the notes that you're each singing. And it seems, so I was listening to your new record, and I want to play the song Go Baby Go, which is you and Deborah Harry. And I was thinking maybe it's just the way you write melody really needs another person to make it like this magic thing. I don't know, because you seem to really love to sing with another person, whether it's on solo records, on X records.
Mm-hmm. Just what you get used to, I guess, or what's enjoyable. But you know, if you had the opportunity to hang out with Debbie Harry for the afternoon, wouldn't you do that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I think you would.
So did
she's the coolest.
Yeah. So did she came out to Arizona to sing her part?
No, I found a studio. Actually, Eric Amble, has a studio in Brooklyn, and she came out there. We had toured with Blondie. X and Blondie toured in like 2014, I think. And I said, if I get a song that I think you'd like, would you sing on it? And she said, sure. And then this Go Baby Go has kind of a garage rock, feel to it. And I thought she'd be perfect on it. And she was... The weirdest thing is that she took about the same amount of time to find the part, like 45 minutes to an hour to get it all down. And then she said, well, what if I double it? And I thought, well, of course, that's kind of a signature Debbie Harry, Blondie kind of sound. And then she did that all in one take. It was as if she was mapping it out as she was finding the parts and finding the timing, and then she just doubled her part.
Boom. She's a pro. Right. Yeah.
She is pro.
Yeah. Well, it's a great song. Let's hear it now. John Doe, next Saturday, November 5th, Outpost in the Burbs. Check the John Doe for buying the record, buying the book, buying tickets to the gig, and I guess information next year about X 40th anniversary. Well, thanks for talking to us this morning.
Been a pleasure. It's always fun to talk to FMU. Actually, I think, let me check. Hold on. Hold, please.
Yeah?
Yes. I have the WFMU cow and dog t-shirt on as we speak.
Ah, the Woof Moo t-shirt. Well, I remember you played on Joe Belock's show, and folks can hear that anytime with, you know, just go to Joe Belock's archives for free anytime. Do it now. All right.
John. Do it now. You'll be glad you did.
Exactly right. No salesman will call. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Hey, man. Always a pleasure.
All right, there's John Doe, the Golden State from A Year in the Wilderness with Kathleen Edwards there. And he's coming, as I said earlier, he's coming to town. He's going to do three dates at Hill Country in Washington, D.C., in Brooklyn, in Manhattan, and then in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Atwood Tavern. John Doe, welcome to the program. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. And a fine Saturday it is.
I love that song. It is... it's very John Doe to me, you know. It just sounds a lot like you. It's very catchy, yet there's something a little not exactly mainstream about it.
Well, I take that as a compliment, that I'm asking a little more of the audience than just to tap their toe, but they still can.
Yeah, well, it's a hard line to be there.
Not really. I mean, if you're a weirdo, then all you'd have to do is just act like you're not, and then you're somewhere in the middle, and hopefully it's not boring to the people that want you to be a complete psych fest.
So that's your secret.
Absolutely. I've just revealed it here on the radio. No, I think it's something you can't really, you can't decide. It's out of your power. You know, Paul McCartney writes catchy pop songs because that's what Paul McCartney does. And, you know, the Velvet Underground did what they did because that's all they could do. And it's just trying to find, like, who the hell are you, and try not to be something that you're not, because you'll probably fail at that. So.
Yeah, well, but you sort of mentioned, you know, trying to deny your weirdo side. And I think, and that's maybe responsible for the catchiness quotient in your music. And it seems like some people have a... maybe that's it. Maybe Paul McCartney just is pushing his weirdo side down way too far.
No, I don't think there is any.
Oh boy, I do.
Some people have no. You know, it's like the old Mojo Nixon song. You know, Elvis is everywhere except for in Michael J. Fox. But I don't know. That was unfair to Michael J. Fox, probably at the time.
Yes,
it was funny.
Yeah.
I think even at the very beginning, X was trying to be, you know, we weren't trying to be obscure or obtuse. We were just trying to have fun and play something that was loud and fast and cool, you know. But we weren't trying to be the, you know, obscure.
Were you trying to, I mean, what were the expectations? Were the expectations we will become rock stars and be on the radio, you know, next to Van Halen?
Oh, hell no. We didn't really care.
Hmm.
I think my expectations were that we would be the next Velvet Underground. And it's weird that I would, you know, call them out twice in two paragraphs, but, yeah, I thought, well, we could do as good as Patti Smith, and lo and behold, that's what we did, except we stuck around a lot longer.
Yeah, I was looking through, you know, I mean, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. You've been making music a long time, but looking at it all on paper, it kind of struck me what a hardworking guy you must be in some ways. You know, I think it's 8 solo records, all the records with X. You've worked with the Sadies, who you're on tour with, the Knitters, Jill Sobule, all kinds of people you've collaborated with, lots and lots of touring. And I kind of thought, like, that didn't surprise me from what I know about you. But it is funny how the word punk comes up over and over and over again. And I think it's a great word. You know, it's a lovely word. But I just thought it's funny. Here's this guy who is, you know, one of the oldest establishing members of the punk community, but he works so hard. You know, it's a funny comparison.
Well, I don't know that punk rock was anti-work. I mean, I just don't have to. I don't have to know what day it is. That's the nicest. That's the best thing. Is I don't have to work in the day. I don't have to get up and go to work. But I also, especially on tour, I don't actually have to know what day it is. I find it's a real success. It doesn't matter. So, yeah. I mean, even the slackerest of slackers, they've got to get out there and tour, and they've got to get out there and sell their wares. And yeah, I like working. I mean, I'm really lucky in that way. I like performing. I don't mind people too much.
The whole idea of what punk means, and I remember I'm a little bit younger than you, and I remember when things started to change and when punk started to get press coverage. People treated it like, you know, Martians from another planet. You know, these people have different color hair. They must be evil, you know. And now it's in commercials. It's in CVS. Yeah. It's everywhere. I would guess you have some mixed feelings about that. But in some way, there's something great about that. And there's also something, I don't know, disappointing.
Well, not really. I mean, it's weird what gets co-opted and what... things become, you know. The hippies gave us like wheat bread. You know, you couldn't really get brown bread before the hippies, and you know, now punk rock is assimilated. You can have a mohawk and not be made fun of. And great, whatever. I mean, I'm working on a book that's going to be out in April, and it's the L.A. punk rock story. I'm doing it with a bunch of people writing chapters. I'm the narrator, and I've written a bunch of chapters as well. But so talking about what punk rock was and what it's become, I did a bunch of research and read all the, you know, Please Kill Me and all the books that have been out. And this is going to be different because everyone gets a chapter. And it's people like Exene or Henry Rollins or Mike Watt or, you know, all these different people that were on the scene in L.A. It's always changing, and reading Please Kill Me, you know, it was changing from 75 to 79 or 78, you know. So it never stays static. Nothing ever does.
Tell me about your childhood and when music first came into your head as something, you know, something that you, when did it touch you, move you first?
You know, I was born in the mid-50s, and when I got aware of what music was, radio was pretty great. And back then, adults, for some reason, thought that folk music was appropriate for children, with all the drinking and murder and people dying and all kinds of things like that. So, like Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie and people like that were, you know, we had these little 10-inch records that had all these crazy songs about...
So your parents bought these for you?
Sure. I mean, everybody, and that was kind of what kids' music was considered. Folk music, you know, Burl Ives and like I said, Lead Belly, and who was a murderer. So, yeah. I mean, the thing that folk, that wave of folk music had tons of images and stories. So, that was a good place to start.
And then, what first time you picked up an instrument was when?
Well, I sang in choirs and stuff like that in school, public school in Baltimore. And my dad played piano. He played kind of classical piano. And my mom sang when she was in college. She sang opera and stuff. And she never did anything with it. But they were pretty musical, even though they had regular jobs. And so there was a piano in the house. I used to fool around on that when I was a kid. And I bought a bass guitar when I was probably 15 or 16 because I thought it would be easier. And guess what? It is.
Only four strings.
But it's only four strings, and you don't have to learn how to play leads. And if you are playing a lead on a bass guitar, you should stop and not play in that band. And that was at the height of psychedelia. That was in like 67, 68. And, you know, I was a elementary school kid when the Beatles and the British Invasion happened. And so it was good. It was a good time.
I mean, tell me, what was the scene in Baltimore? I mean, what kind of gigs were there to happen?
There were none. That's why I moved to L.A.
I mean, you're playing, there must have been some cover band. I mean, there must have been something.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I played, one of the strangest situations I was in was playing the song Imagine that, you know, John Lennon did at a revolving restaurant on the top of Holiday Inn in Washington, D.C., and there were really high-priced prostitutes picking up, like, you know, junior senators and things like that. I'm thinking, imagine there's no people or there's no countries or, you know, all that kind of thing. It was just so perfectly weird. I had been to New York in 75, seen Talking Heads and saw the Heartbreakers and thought, shit, this is all happening. But I couldn't stand the East Coast. I was done with that and just loved, like, California, and it's a good place.
Okay, it's so warm. It's warm. So you moved to California, and I want to know, is there like a something literally in the air? You know, is there something you can feel going around that saying something's got to change?
I think there is. I think there's a different kind of light. You know, people talk about the light in New Mexico or in the south of France, or, you know, stuff like that, where, you know, a lot of painters and I think there is. There's like distance. There's openness. There's a kind of like exhaust fumes and mountains. Sometimes you can see the mountains, and sometimes you can't. So. Yeah, but the light and the you can in the East Coast, you know, it's difficult to see more than like a couple of miles, and in the West you can see 50 miles easy.
So how did you find your kindred spirits when you got to Los Angeles?
Through poetry. I met Exene at a poetry workshop, writing workshop, and I met Billy Zoom through the Recycler, which was a paper you could, you know, buy a refrigerator or find a lead singer.
Yeah, it was Craigslist on paper, basically.
Yes, yeah.
Exactly. So let's talk about poetry. I mean, it seems like poetry's always been important to you. How does, I assume since you were a child, since a high school student, how do you get into poetry, and is that a ballsy choice?
Not really. I mean, I think that, you know, ever since Jim Morrison or Bob Dylan or Joni Mitchell, it was like, this is a part of the deal. And even, you know, going back into blues songs, you know, Howlin' Wolf or Robert Johnson or that kind of thing. I mean, all those great songs was poetry, but not in an academic way. I studied it at Antioch College in Baltimore, so I kind of knew what it was about, and then I actually ran a poetry reading series in Baltimore for about a year and a half with a couple friends. And so, yeah, that was one thing. That was our ace in the hole that you know, writers like to talk about, because Exene is a natural poet, and I'm a little more studied, but still threw away a lot of those lessons.
Let's talk about your singing voice. It is it's very identifiable as you, sort of, as I said at the top of the show, and it's very open. It's very, to me, it just sounds like it's you're not holding back. Is that a conscious thing? Is that something you had to work your way up to or learn? Is that just what happened when you open your mouth?
I think I had to, if anything, scale back. I had to learn how to sing quieter rather than not to sing all out all the time.
You're singing Imagine, and the guy in the band is saying that is too much?
Well, with rock and roll, punk rock singing, it was really unbridled, and that was kind of the point of it. I loved the way Richard Hell sang, even though it was kind of off kilter. But I could hear that, and I could take some lessons from that. But because of the volume of the band, it was kind of all out, sing hard, and then doing solo stuff. Then I realized, and I love like blues singers that are, you know, full on, just shouting and stuff. But then maybe 15 years ago, I started thinking, well, maybe I could sing a little quieter and it would be interesting, and then kind of like use the dynamics a little more.
So you moved to L.A. Did you have to have real jobs?
Sure. I was not given a Mercedes and a swimming pool as soon as I arrived in Los Angeles, much to my chagrin. And everybody in New York thought that, what the hell, they just... What do they have to be mad about? They live in Los Angeles. But, yeah, I worked in the bookstore. I actually worked at Brentano's, which was a chain back then, and it was in the Beverly Hills Hotel, which was awesome. I got to see all kinds of stars, and it was in Beverly Hills. It was kind of being in the belly of the beast. And I helped Gloria Swanson find some diet books. She was like vegan in the 30s or 40s, and she was tiny. She was like 5'10". She weighed about 75 pounds. It was awesome.
That sounds amazing.
This is Gloria Swanson, for God's sake.
Yeah.
She was 110, but still, it was just like, holy moly, this is like a real movie star.
I lived in L.A. for a few years, and I thought it was interesting how you did see movie stars all the time, just, you know, at the farmer's market or at the supermarket, anywhere, just driving around. They were just, it's Hollywood.
Everybody got to be somewhere.
It's surreal, exactly. They got to get by groceries also. So you find Billy Zoom in the recycler, and you hook up with Xene, and eventually you get DJ, and there's X, and the band starts playing and signed pretty quickly, I think, to Slash Records. And the expectations, you said, were to, like, you know, Patti Smith or Velvet Underground, something like that. And like you said, the press kind of latched onto you guys because you, I guess you were probably better interviews than some and popular. So tell me, though, I mean, what was the shows like? I kind of remember, you know, there was shows in that time, because I was just a kid then, but I was going to shows, and there were some people fully into the sort of punk look, and yet there were guys who looked like they were still in the 70s in disco clothes, and it was like a very... People don't remember that not everybody was like an extra in a movie about punk rock.
That is so weird, because that's just come up a couple times in this in doing this book, and it's so true. Yeah, there were a lot of people that looked like complete nerds. And so what? Great.
Yeah.
I mean, even in the earlier days, because there weren't, you know, there wasn't Vivienne Westwood, and we all, I mean, some of us kind of looked down our noses at the Sex Pistols because of that. It's like, what the? You got to dress up, you know, just go to a thrift store and find some old jeans and have fun with the, you know, rather than having designer stuff. But you know, to be fair, like how did we find each other? I think everybody found each other because there was something in the air, and that's why it happened in New York and London and L.A. kind of in that order so quickly. You know, from 75 to 70, early 77.
Can you put your finger on that thing? And does it have anything to do with sort of what you talked about earlier, hippies? Is there some like line that connects it
with what went before?
Yeah, you know, connects like the...
Yeah, we all owe Journey and the Eagles and Bob Seger, we all owe them a great debt, because they had so totally alienated a lot of people from what rock and roll music was supposed to be that everybody said, oh, no, you don't. You're not this up. We're going to take this back, and we're going to make it fun again. You can't put this in big stadiums only. So, yeah, that's what I think happened.
So after two records, you guys moved to Elektra, which is, you know, part of Warner Brothers' giant label. Did they say...
Oh, no. We thought Elektra would take care of us, because the Stooges and the MC5 and the Doors... and Love, they were all on Elektra. And this guy, Joe Smith, who signed us, just sort of, I don't know why he did it, because he thought, well, I know why he did it, because we sold out the Greek Theater, which is 7,000 people, and we had two records on some dumb label called Slash, you know, an indie label that had terrible distribution. But we sold out an outdoor 7,000-seat place. They're finally thinking, well, okay, we can't be this stupid and just, you know, keep our heads buried in the ground and think that classic rock is all that there is.
And do you think they understood where you guys were coming from or what you wanted to do? Did they care?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we didn't. So why the hell would they? We didn't know what we were doing. We just were doing what we did.
You were just going. So they didn't sit you in a room and say, "Kid, we're going to make a video, and you know, and we're going to get your real producer, and we're going to make hit records." Was there any of that?
No, because we had Ray Manzarek, and Ray was you know, rock royalty. I think it was a little bit. You know, I talked to a guy who was part of Geffen when Nirvana blew up. And I said, "Did you guys have any idea what was going on?" And they said, "Nope. We just said, let's keep pressing records and step out of the way."
Yeah.
And to their credit, that's what they did.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't really get much A&R-ing because they didn't understand it, and we were just doing our thing.
Yeah. Let me remind everybody, John Doe is our guest, and as I said earlier, he's coming to town with the Sadies to the Hill Country Barbecue restaurant/venue, the one in Brooklyn and the one in Manhattan next weekend, the 23rd and 24th, but also to the Hill Country in D.C. and also to Atwood's Tavern in Cambridge, and you can check the, T-H-E-E, johndoe.com for information and links to all that stuff. And I'm sure those are going to be great shows because there's always something going on with you there's always something good with all of your work. Tell me about now you're on the road with X. Tell me about good and bad double bills. Tell me like great bands you got to see during that time or terrible double bill bands.
Oh my. Well, all the great bands were people that were our contemporaries and a bunch of people like Jane's Addiction and Chili Peppers and Go-Go's and all those people, you know, opened for us and that was great. Terrible double bills. We had a pretty difficult tour with Warren Zevon because his fans didn't like us and our fans didn't like him and we didn't particularly like each other. I don't know why we did it. But that was in like 87, I think. Billy Zoom had already left the band, and Tony Gilkison was soldiering on, that was kind of hard. But you know, we got to play with some really cool people. You know, and we got to do some TV shows with Chuck Berry and the Temptations, and it was called and James Brown, and we played the first Farm Aid and all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But can I just say that when you announced all those gigs and everything, that was so professional. Can I just say that I am like, I give you some props, as the kids like to say, because that was really like hip and just boom, there you go.
Well, you're welcome. I do want to, you know, remind everybody what's going on. It's part of all I'm here to help direct people's weekend night activities.
By the way, I have an FMU shirt that I wear quite a bit. The one that has the dog and the cow.
Yeah, Woof Moo.
Woof Moo. Yeah.
I wear the one, that same one. Thank you.
I wear it proudly.
It's a groovy shirt. Talk about songwriting. As I said in the beginning, you're so prolific. You are such a you know, does it take a long time? Is it like lightning striking? Is it hard work? How does it happen?
More lightning. I wait for more inspiration, but I'll have a store of pieces of writing, and then when I just figure, okay, it's time to write a new record, I'll have some other pieces of music, and I'll match them up. Similar to the way that I did with X. But nowadays, I'm not all that prolific. You know, I put a record out every 3 to 4 years. I have a new one coming out in April, if I can just figure out who's going to put it out and how. But it'll definitely be on vinyl.
So you're a notebook guy. You're jotting in.
Yeah, but I don't do like subjects. You know, I'm going to write a song on the trees. Trees. What do the trees mean to, you know, something like that. It's more like just a musical phrase, an idea, some kind of like the pattern of words, and then it'll start a subject, and then it'll be about something, and I don't necessarily know what it is. So it has a rhythm and a pattern, and it's about something, sort of. And then I do a lot of editing afterward. And, you know, I'll wait until it's inspiring me again.
Is sort of having a background in poetry, is that are you harder on yourself? You know, does each word become?
No, I don't. I'm not constipated in writing. I just sort of do it as it happens, and it's all. I just kind of I've learned how to let it flow, and this is so scatological. Anyway,
you're not constipated, but you've learned how to let it flow. Okay.
Yeah. Oh God, so embarrassing. So early in the morning, so embarrassing. Anyway, no, because I do know some people that write, and they're so precious, and they're like prying every word out of their mouth, and it's just kind of just let it go, and then figure it out later. What I find lately, within the last 10-15 years, is the little words, if you change little things here and there, it can make a big difference, like just articles, like in or on or, you know, stuff like that.
Are there songs that you wrote, you know, 40 years ago that you sing now with X that you don't relate to anymore?
Not in the way that I did then, but, you know, they were universal enough. We didn't say, you know, Ronald Reagan sucks too much. Xine was very, very crafty about the political songs that she wrote. Most of those, The New World and I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts, and, you know, when you're talking about, we were talking about El Salvador, but it relates to the Middle East just as easily. So
talk about, I think you're a parent, is that right?
Oh yeah, I have three daughters. They're grown and beautiful.
I'm curious, how was that experience for you? Were you a good parent?
I think so, yeah. I'm still in touch with them. I live close by them, and we see each other all the time. So I must have done something right. They didn't, you know, say, screw you and move to the other side of the country. that's a whole, like, two-hour, two-day interview, but it's not the only thing, and I kind of resent it when people say, oh, my God, my kids, blah, 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 and they go on and on and on. And it's like, I love my kids. They're incredible, and having boundaries is a good thing. So you don't just give up your entire life for your children. It's one really positive element of one's life.
Yeah.
Can be.
I was looking, you know, I've seen you.
And not to mention, I'm incredibly fortunate that they're healthy and they're not in jail and they're not drug addicts, and all those things are possible as well.
I've seen you acting over the years, but I didn't realize how much until, again, I looked at it on paper. You've been in so many television shows and movies. I mean, like 100, you know, like an actor, you know, like so many.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you don't do stuff you don't enjoy, so I'm assuming you enjoy doing that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's another kind of creative thing. I take it really seriously when I get a job, but you have to get someone to give you a job. And I'm pretty mercenary about it, actually. It's like, okay, how much time and how much money? But I've been really fortunate to make a couple of good friends like Allison Anders and you know, had a chance to work in some pretty high-end things like Roadhouse. The most expensive B-movie ever made, and I stand by that.
Yeah. People love that movie, to watch it in cable late at night. And
People have you know, like Roadhouse parties,
yeah.
and they have Roadhouse-themed showings of it where people show up as the, you know, crappy bouncer and the you know, airheaded, busty babe. You know, it's so insane. It's cultish now.
Yes, it's the Rocky Horror Picture Show of the 80s. Yeah,
yeah.
I don't know.
Weird.
So do you go auditions? Are you that kind of an actor?
I have. Yeah, I have and do. You know, nowadays you just do it on your phone. It's so strange.
Oh.
You do it in your house, and your, you know, friend or sweetheart holds the phone, and you do some acting against a, a white wall, and it's very bizarre. And then you load it on your computer and send it in to your agent, and then they send it off. Usually you hear nothing.
You just finished a tour with X, a pretty long tour. You're touring with X in December, starting with a couple nights at the Roxy right there on beautiful Sunset Boulevard. I know Billy Zoom is not well. He's sick, and part of, I think, the message of these shows is to kind of get some support going for him. X is, there's four interesting people in that band. I know Billy was out of the band for a while, but, you know these guys for 40 years, you know, and I know that when you're on tour, you're like 3 feet from them on stage and 3 feet from them in a van and 3 feet from them in the coffee shop. And you know each other's jokes by now. And, you have a long relationship with Xene. So what's it like, you know, to know these guys for 40 years? What's it like to be with them now and to know that?
Oh, God.
Another 2 hours we need?
Yeah, that's a book. And I'll have to write that one next. It's a family, you know, for better or for worse. I don't know what your family's like, but families are complicated. But at the same time, you love them. And you can't imagine what it would be like without them. Even though you may want to kill him at times. So, Billy has got a great prognosis with bladder cancer. He's in, like, on a maintenance kind of thing, and Jesse Dayton, who I played with in my solo band, has stepped in, and he filled in for Billy when he couldn't tour in December. It might be both of them. I don't even know, because Billy's just getting over the first round of treatment. So, yeah. I'm connected to Xene in a way that is unlike a lot of relationships, and she is an amazing partner, and so it's a great thing, and I think we're all finally realizing after 40 years, because it'll be 40 years in 2017.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It'll be 40 years that the band has been around. Yeah, I know, it's frightening, but. Yeah, you realize that it's got legs, it's got legacy, it's got longevity and a bunch of other L words.
You know, you think about, like, you know, I don't know, something like Sgt. Pepper that people are always having anniversaries or birthdays for, and, you know, it's only, whatever, it's less than 10 years older than X, you know, yet somehow that seems like a whole different, you know, there's no relevance. It's only nostalgia that we look at Sgt. Pepper, whereas X is somehow, even though it's really almost the same age as Sgt. Pepper, it seems so much more contemporary. I don't know.
It's a strange thing. I mean, if you think about the New York scene and the L.A. scene, the core of it only lasted about 2 years. It's so bizarre because it so much happened in such a short period of time. And the same goes, I mean, the same goes from, like, the beginning of the beatniks in, you know, the late 40s to the, like, integration movement and Vietnam and psychedelic bands and boom, 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 boom. And it was all pretty quick. Yeah.
As I said in the beginning of the show, you seem to be a busy guy. But what do you do? What do you do when you don't have work? And you make your own breakfast. You told me you just finished making your breakfast. What do you do all day?
I do normal stuff, and then I do some dreaming, and I have a couple horses that I have at a crappy stables, and my daughter and I go out and ride them, and I love being around them because they make you slow down, and I hang out with my sweetheart and make food and screw around.
It sounds good.
Yeah. I'll never be rich, but I have a good time.
John Doe is our guest, the John Doe, T-H-E-E, johndoe.com, for information about those gigs at Hill Country and up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And like I said, X touring in December, really almost the entire month of December, mostly on the West Coast there. Tell me about the Sadies quickly, because I love that you made a record with them. We're going to hear It Just Dawned on Me. They're guys from Canada, the land of Michael J. Fox. Tell me how you hooked up. How'd you hook up with them?
We're both on Yep Rock Records, and we did a festival in Toronto about 2007 or 2008. And I was a big fan of theirs, records and stuff they'd done with Nico Case, and I said, what if you played on a few songs, which they learned, and we did, and then we got, you know, drunk and said, let's make a record together, and instead of just forgetting about it, we actually did it. And I thought about making a country western type record for a long time, but it always seemed kind of boring. I mean, you talked about, you know, what my voice is like, and I don't have a really, I may have be able to sing, but I don't have a really unique sounding voice like, you know, Billie Holiday or Bob Dylan or something like that. So to put my voice with a standard country western band, it would just be dull, I thought. But the Sadies are anything but standard. They're crazy, and but they play a style of, they have really broad influences. They play a style of country music that's really unique. So that's why we made the record, and we took all the best songs we could think of and that we could get away with and put them on a record, like Waylon Jennings songs and Tammy Wynette and Hank Williams and whatever we could get away with.
Johnny Cash, yeah, but then there's this one song, It Just Dawned on Me, which you wrote with Exene. Do you remember writing the song or what the genesis of the song was?
Yeah, Exene had a really horrible husband. and she kind of just told me, you know, was talking about how she wished he'd just go away. And then I wrote the song. And eventually he did, thank God.
It is amazing that sometimes it does just, you know, a light bulb goes off and you think, yeah, I'm in a relationship I shouldn't be in. You know, what's inside us that makes us stay in those situations? I don't know.
Oh, you know, self-loathing and low self-esteem. I don't know either.
Well, I've really enjoyed our chat this morning.
The good thing about the John Doe and Sadies show is that the Sadies get to do some of their songs. I do a few solo songs. We do a couple X songs, and then we do all this other country western stuff, which is like comfort food, and it's really, they're such an incredible band. I mean, they backed up all kinds of other artists, like, you know, John Langford or Andre Williams, and they just have so much musicality and without being too precious about it. They just let it rip, and it's so much fun.
Well, John Doe, thanks so much. Let's hear It Just Dawned on Me, because, again, just a terrific song, and you can go see... do you do this one live?
Oh, yeah.
So maybe you can see this one Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday next week. Check out thejohndoe.com for information. Thanks.
Sure, Michael. That was long and pretty fun.
Years sleeping in our bed, resting your pretty little head. You started sleeping lighter and lighter every night. You were already up making coffee by the dawn's early light. Well, I was happy. Mama and your daddy slept in a soft feather bed. I hope you wind up in the jailhouse. with a cement floor for your head. 'Cause I'll be happy dreaming in our happy home. I'll wake up, I'll be alone. It just dawned on me, you're gone. Thank God you're gone.